All I had in the world was $60 in cash. That's all I had to my name. But I did the math. And I determined that $60 happened to be the tithe for 600, which is what I needed. So this is what I did. I took all that money out of my drawer. This was the money that I was going to live on, I was going to buy groceries with for the rest of the term. I took it out of my drawer, and I went to church that Sunday, and I dropped it in the offering plate. And then I said to God, okay, I have paid my tithe in advance. Now you owe me $600. Desperate times call for desperate measures. And then I went home, and I just studied away. That was on Sunday. Monday morning, I got a call from a buddy of mine who worked in the financial aid office. His name was Francisco. And he called me up because he knew my situation, and he said, Jordan, a check for $800 just appeared for you in the financial aid office. Come and get it. So I hung up the phone, and I ran down to the financial aid office, and I walked into the office, and I got the check, and I hurried to the bank, and I deposited it because I figured there was a mistake. But I got the $800 in my checking account, and I was able to pay the bill. And I shared this story to my fellowship group on campus later that week, and some wise guy said to me, "You owe God 20 bucks." is that a cool story?
Yeah.
Is that good? The point is, on the basis of what I had already learned from my life with God, that I already learned from my conversation, my experience with God, I actually kind of told God what to do, didn't I? Right? But it fit with what I knew about the God who provides. Right? It's like I was presuming upon God, but I was presuming on God in a way that kind of matched up with what I knew his nature to be. God had always been faithful. He was always provided for me. Okay, I was looking for a way to kind of spur him into action, shall we say. I wanted to lead him to do what I needed him to do, and I stepped out in faith. God went with it, and to this day, I do not know where that check came from. I don't know. Came from God. And I never asked. I never asked the financial aid office. It was just written out to me by Stanford. The reason God went with it, I think, is because it was so in keeping what God had always taught me about himself. I was dictating to him, sure, but I was appealing to what I already knew about him, and I was appealing to my relationship with him. It's kind of like I was saying, God, you're into me, you're into what I'm trying to do, so here's my step of faith, now, where's yours? And that sort of tickled God, evidently. It sort of marked a turning point in my relationship with God, actually. I'd always tried to be wherever God was going, because that's what I was taught to do. But one thing that conversation and experience with God teaches you is that God is also willing to be wherever you're going. You think that's true? Do you think so? Do you think you can actually determine where God goes and what he does? Do you think that is within your power? We have 2 votes and 148 abstentions. Cowards. Well, let's take a look at it, and let's see if I'm stating things accurately or not. I think that one of the great advantages of hearing the voice of God, one of the things that we've been talking about these past few weeks, is that if you hear the voice of God, you can know what he's up to, and you can follow his lead. But one of the great advantages of a life lived in conversation with God is that you can actually get him to follow your lead. You can buddy up with him. Conversing with God develops a back and forth, give and take way of relating. And this is exactly what you want with God. This is when it gets fun, and this is when it gets affectionate and fond. He loves it, I think, when we go to him with an idea, because we think he'll like it. Because when we do that, it shows that we know his character and that we believe he's terribly fond of us. And he's into that. Relationship is a two-way street, and our God is so humble that he's willing to embrace that sort of two-way relationship. So you've heard of this guy called Moses? You've heard of him? Moses? It's kind of big prophet dude, giver of the law, and stuff like that. How many of you are familiar with the story of Moses? Sort of more or less, sort of read it in the Bible. All right. Moses is called the greatest prophet of the Bible. He gets a whole bunch of press in the Bible, second to only Jesus, really. Well, the deal was that Moses was born a Hebrew. And when Moses was born, the Hebrews were an oppressed, enslaved group of people in the Egyptian Empire. And the Egyptians were mistreating them. The Hebrews were prospering, they were multiplying, they were breeding really fast. And so the Pharaoh gives this order, if a boy child is born to the Hebrews, the boy child must be killed. The girls were allowed to live, but all the boy children were killed. Moses' mom doesn't want to kill him. It says, when he was born, she saw that he was a handsome child, and so preserved his life, it says in the original. And she hid him out until he was 3 months old. And then, as many of you know, she put him in a basket, a waterproof basket, and left him in the reeds on the shore of the Nile River. Pharaoh's daughter came to bathe in the river, found the baby. Moses' sister came out and said, "Oh, Pharaoh's daughter, you found a baby. I know a woman in the village who can wet nurse him for you." And so Moses' mother gets to wean her own child. And then Moses goes to live in the household of Pharaoh via Pharaoh's daughter. And he grows up an Egyptian prince, more or less. That's what happens. Disney has a great cartoon on this. You can watch it sometime. He has a tremendous life. All sorts of unique circumstances. He grows up with power and privilege. And then, about the age of 40, he's conscious of his Hebrew heritage. He's walking out there in the fields one day, and he sees an Egyptian mistreating a couple Hebrew slaves. And Moses decides at that point to take the matter into his own hands, and he kills the abusive Egyptian. The power evidently had gone to his head. He kills the Egyptian, and events progress in such a way that the deed is discovered, and Pharaoh tries to kill Moses for doing this nasty thing, for murdering this Egyptian, and Moses runs away into the foreign land, into the desert, where he becomes a shepherd of goats out in the wilderness, working for a foreign tribe. It's a very humiliating way of life for a Hebrew, let alone an Egyptian prince. Shepherds were considered unclean. And Hebrews were not supposed to marry into foreign tribes, but he did. He married this foreign woman named Zipporah, and he sets up a little shepherding life for himself. And another 40 years pass. So he's about 80 now. He's getting on. And one day he's wandering around the wilderness, shepherding his goats, and he sees, of course, a burning bush. And God speaks to him out of the burning bush. And that's the first text that you will find in your bulletin tonight. From Exodus chapter 3. So Moses thought, "I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up." When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the burning bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "Here I am." "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." And then he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Remember this. Moses initially was afraid of God. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey." That must have been interesting, an interesting statement to Moses, who at one time was also concerned about delivering his Hebrew brethren from the Egyptians. It didn't work out so well when Moses tried it. Now God is saying, "I'm into it now, Moses." That's good news. "And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me," God said, "and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them, so now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" God is choosing exactly the wrong guy, right? Moses has no legitimacy in this area anymore, but God picks him. And God said in reply, "I will be with you." That apparently is all that Moses needs to know. Well, you follow the conversation on there in the story of Exodus. And first, Moses hesitates. He says, no, God, you've picked the wrong guy. I am not a man eloquent of speech. Evidently, Moses had some sort of speech impediment, a stutter or something like that. God says, well, you're going to go anyway. Moses said, how are they going to believe me? God said to Moses, well, I'll empower you to do some miracles. Anyway, they work it out. Moses goes to Egypt to deliver the Israelites. You might know the story. There are some plagues involved. And eventually the Hebrews get delivered from their Egyptian oppressors, and Moses leads them out of Egypt through the Red Sea, parting of the Red Sea. They go into the wilderness, and it kind of works out. And, you know, Disney writes great crescendos, music, lots of brass as they pass through the Red Sea. Triumph! They've been delivered from Egypt. It works out well. But then the Israelites blow it. Despite all they have seen God do for them, all the miracles, the plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, the Israelites kind of get freaked out in the desert. What happens is that Moses leads the Israelites to the Mount of Sinai. And there God decides he's going to meet with his people. So he shows up on the mountain in a big cloud, lightning flashes. It's all very impressive, lots of special effects. Upon seeing this, the Israelites say to Moses, hey, this is freaking us out. You talked to God for us. Because we don't want to deal with this. In chapter 20, this is what they say exactly. When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled in fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen to you, but do not have God speak to us because we feel like we're going to die. So they sort of turned down the meeting with God. They turned down conversation with God and said, I tell you what, Moses, you talk to God and you tell us what he says, and that's good enough for us. Moses goes up on Mount Sinai and he spends several weeks up there getting what we call the Ten Commandments. And while he's up in Mount Sinai, what do the Israelites do, Bible scholars? They build this thing called the Golden Calf. And this is what happens. Moses disappears into the cloud. The Israelites are scared to begin with. And after he's gone for, you know, 5 or 6 weeks, they say, Aaron, would you please build us a God that we can worship, a God that we can understand? That's what happens. They still want a God, but they don't want the scary God that makes their leader disappear on the mountain. They don't want the scary God that talks to them from the cloud. God discovers the golden calf, and he gets really upset. And then he immediately reminds them that he had commanded them not to build idols. He says that's a really stupid thing. I think what happened for the Israelites is that they wanted a God, but they wanted a God that was manageable, not a God that they needed to relate to. Because when you relate to God and you're scared of him, it's a very trying experience. Moses was scared of God when he first met him. The Israelites were scared of God when they first met him. We have a tendency as humans, I think, to try and make relating to God more manageable, more predictable, less fluid. I think a lot of our religious systems do this. Right? When you relate to a big God who can be scary, it's nicer just to create for yourself a little liturgical service, a little religion where you just have to go through a few ceremonies and that takes care of your relating to God. If you're scared of God, that's very comforting, right? Idols kind of do the same thing. Sort of scared of God. Well, let's just say that God is kind of like a calf, a golden calf, and then we can make some sacrifices and call it good and then go party. Because that kind of God does not impinge on your life, right? That God is very manageable. Not so relatable in other ways. It is kind of hard to talk to a religious system. It is kind of hard to talk to, you know, a golden calf. You know, they are mute. But I think that's the impulse that the Israelites are acting out of. Everybody understand? They kind of follow me. God wanted to meet with his people, He wanted to display something of his nature. And they said, you know, that kind of relating freaks us out. We're not ready for that. We're going to dumb it down a little bit. You know, make it a little bit easier for us. Aaron builds an altar in front of the golden calves. And he says, this is an altar to the Lord, right? To the real God. Implicitly what he's saying is, you can relate to God by sacrificing to these calves. God, of course, doesn't buy it. In fact, he gets quite upset. And we pick up the story in Exodus chapter 32. I have seen these people, the Lord said, after discovering the idols. I have seen these people, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation, he says. I've had it with these people. They have rejected talking to me. You, Moses, have accepted talking to me. So I'll tell you what. I'll destroy them and I'll make you my chosen people. We'll just sort of birth a tribe out of you. This is a good offer for Moses, I think, right? There's a lot of glory involved, but Moses responds in verse 32 of the same chapter, and he says, Lord, please now forgive their sin. Forget about it, God. But if you do not, then blot me out of the book you have written. Moses said, Lord, you know, forgive them. And if you can't forgive them, if you're going to destroy them, then destroy me too. This is clever of Moses. Why? I think he has an inkling that God kind of likes him. I think it's starting to dawn on him. He essentially offers himself as a hostage. And God says, okay, I'll tell you what, I will not destroy them. They can go on their way to the promised land, but he says in chapter 33, verse 3, but I will not go with them. In other words, I'm not going to destroy them, but their relationship is over. I'm not going to talk to them anymore. We're not going to hang out. That part is done. Moses lets a little time pass, but then he presses the issue further, and this will be up on the big screen. Exodus 33, beginning at verse 15. Then Moses said to him, yeah, but Lord, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? Nice. And the Lord said to Moses, I will do the very thing you have asked because I am pleased with you. I'm pleased with you, Moses, and know you by name. Then Moses said, now, show me your glory. Literally, show me your face. You remember at the beginning? God appears in the burning bush and Moses hides because he did not want to see the face of God. Now he says, show me everything. Why? What has Moses learned? God is all powerful and kind. He has a relationship with God. I think Moses is learning that God is really into him. And it makes Moses really confident. What I like about this story, this whole thing, and that's the end of our Bible story today, is that Moses gets God to change his mind. Moses gets the unchanging God to change his mind. God says, that's it, I'm going to destroy the people. I'm going to destroy them. And then Moses says, no, don't destroy them. If you insist on destroying them, destroy me too. God says, okay, I won't destroy them, but I'm not going to hang out with them anymore. And then Moses says, look, if you're pleased with me, if you want to make me special, then your presence has to go with us. And God says, okay, I'll do it. We'll let bygones be bygones. It's like Moses said to him, look, Lord, all-knowing God, you're not really seeing this accurately. If you do what you say, if you don't go with us, then how will anybody know that we're a special people? I love the way Moses says it. He says, How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and your people unless you go with us? The thing that fascinates me about that is God has just said he is not pleased with his people. Right? But Moses conveniently forgets that, but puts in a plank and says, how will anyone know you're pleased with me and with your people? All right, Moses is leveraging his personal relationship with God to get God to do what he wants God to do for the Hebrews. God, Moses has God wrapped around his little finger, and he knows it. He's getting his way. He's manipulating the God of the universe. Moses wrongly assumes that God is pleased with his people, and the Lord changes his mind. Why does the Lord change his mind? He says, because I am pleased with you, Moses, and I know you by name. What do you think that phrase means? I know you by name. I'm close to you. What was that? They've been talking. They're friends, right? They're on a first name basis, actually. And God has declared his name to Moses. We find out earlier. It's like God is saying, because you and I are buds, we'll just let this thing go, right? I'll relent. I will change my mind. Here's the principle. We are free to contradict God, provided it pleases him. We are free to disagree with God and to petition God to change his mind. We're free to bargain with God, provided we do it in a way that pleases him. This is bad theology, but it's excellent relationship. And what I like about God is that relationship always trumps theology. What pleases God about Moses' bargaining for the Israelites in this story? I think it's that Moses asks for God's presence. That is, he asks for more relationship. Come on, God, you want to hang out with us. You know you do. That's sort of the attitude. And Moses leverages his relationship. He appeals to the relationship. He appeals to the relationship. And that makes God do what he wants God to do. The people had rejected relationship with God. Right? No, we don't want to talk to him. But Moses embraces it and uses it to get what he wants for the sake of his people. The people treat God as if God is scary and overwhelming. Moses treats God as if he's influenceable, as if he can influence God. And that's the difference. This passage is a famous one. Theologians, scholars talk a lot about this passage because it shows God changing his mind. And this gives scholars fits. Right? Because God is supposed to be an unchanging God. The Bible says that God is an unchanging God, that his ways are higher than our ways. There are indications in the Bible that God doesn't change his mind. How does an omniscient, all-knowing God change his mind? But Moses did not know that. Moses thought about it like this. God is a big God, and he really likes me. I'm going to try and get him to do what I want. And this really excites God. God really likes it. God is always a sucker for relational appeals. I don't know that you've ever heard God called a sucker before, but I don't think he would be offended. God is a sucker for relational appeals. You know, God, won't you love me? If you love me, how about this? Is that a good way to talk to God? Yeah. Evidently, yeah, because the greatest prophet of all time tried it, and it worked. And I would say that this actually is the most important thing there is to know about God. The most important thing. That God is a sucker for relationship. If you know that, then you're in a really good position. My daughter is 4. I learn a lot about relating to God from my daughter and the way she relates to me. Because she's like a little relational genius. She's 4 years old. And we have on her bookshelf in her room a book called Daddy's Girl. And it's a collection of poetry by Garrison Keillor, the guy who does Prairie Home Companion radio show. And there's it's kind of poetry and songs. And the opening verses in the book, it's from a song called Daddy's Girl. And I read it to her, and, you know, it's about this daddy celebrating his little girl. You know, she's the cutest little girl. When she walks down the street, everybody notices her. She says hi to everyone. And, you know, it just kind of goes on and on. And she knows that I like to read it to her. And she knows that I like to think of her as daddy's girl. So this is what she started to do lately. We read before bedtime, and she hates to go to bed. So the other night, she had been up late, and I said, "Jojo, it's time to go to bed." And she said, "No, Daddy, no, I want to, want to play with my animals." She was doing a little animal picnic. I said, "Honey, we're going to go to bed right now. One, two," and then she says, "Will you read Daddy's Girl to me?" Yeah. She totally has me wrapped around. What can you do? Right? What can you? So I read her the book. Right? She appealed to the relationship. And we can do the same thing with God. Right? The most important thing to know about talking to God, and this is a sermon series on talking to God, is that he's really into relationship with you. Right? Your conversation with him counts. It's not just you trying to figure out what he wants you to do. Right? It's you talking about what to do. You know, maybe you can convince him that your idea is a good idea. That's not theological, but it's very, very relational. It will change the way that you converse with God. The latitude that God gives us is amazing. And for me, this changes everything. It's possible to approach prayer and worship as an exercise in getting it right, you know, as in if you do it the right way, God will be pleased to you. But what pleases God is that you're into relationship with him. It's not that you do it right. It's just that you're into it that counts. See the difference? The disciples saw this in Jesus. They saw that he prayed to God in a certain way, and they asked him famously, "Lord, teach us to pray." And then the Lord teaches his disciples what we call the Lord's Prayer. What are the two most important words in the Lord's Prayer? Our Father. And literally in the Aramaic, our Abba, our daddy. Right? The first thing that Jesus taught them about praying to God was call him daddy. Call him daddy. That was the first thing. Right? Jojo knows that. Is God the scary, lightning, flashing, smoking cloud on the mountain type God? Or is he a daddy? Well, it depends, I think. It depends how you want to relate to him. How are you going to relate to him? Are you going to be scared of him, or are you going to treat him like a daddy? That's the issue. So this is a series on hearing the voice of God. So think about this. Mental exercise. If you believe that God is the kind of guy that wants to be friends with you, you're more likely to expect him to speak to you, right? So that's one advantage. The best way to hear God is to assume that he's speaking to you. He's into that. That's how relationships develop. So let's take this Moses story and think about how to apply it. To end, we'll do this application exercise. How to apply it, how to let it help us in our conversation with God. All right, ready? A little exercise to end it. Somebody tell me something that you think God is really into. Wait. Some value or some cause dear to his heart.
Love.
Love. Okay, good. You went way out on the limb. You chose love. All right. Something a little more interesting. Not that love isn't important. That you think God is kind of into. I heard murmur. What? The poor and the sick? Those are all really safe Christian answers. What do you have?
Sharing your testimony with female prisoners.
So Don has started visiting prisoners. Do you think God is really into prisoners? Okay, that's pretty specific. Okay, so what could you do that is in keeping with that value? God is really into prisoners. What could you do and keep that's in keeping with that value? Preferably, make your answer a little selfish. What would you enjoy doing? You would enjoy doing miracles in prison. All right? You have to get arrested. Does everybody have something like that in their head? Something that God is into and that you think that... You have another example, Marty? God is into prescription drug coverage, because that would be helpful to a lot of people. So the justice issues, like taking care of people in practical ways, another suggestion. You all have something like that? healing? Okay, now ask yourself, what could you do in keeping with that cause, with that thing that you're thinking of, that would never work unless God gave you some help? Are you following the exercise? All right, so think of a thing that you think God is really into, and then think, well, okay, here's something that I could do in that vein, but make it something that would never work unless God helped you out in some amazing way. I'll give you a second. You got something? No, it doesn't have to be the... These are just examples. You don't have to go to prison. You don't have to think about prescription drugs. Just things that are on your mind. All right? You're looking at me blankly. Somebody inspire me with confidence. Okay, thank you. All right. Can you think of a reason not to try to do this thing? Some reason that God would be against it. No? All right, so this is your assignment. Talk to God about this thing. Talk to God about it right now. See what he says. Good. Close your eyes if you have to. But here's a thing that you think God is into. You've come up with an idea that you'd like to try in relation to it. Make it big enough that you could never succeed unless God helped you. And now talk to God about it. And talk to God like Moses would. Lord, I've got an idea. You're gonna love it. See what he says. I'll give you a minute to think of it. The worship band's gonna come up and lead us in one final song.